Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, one of my good buddies, one of my favorite people in music, a musical hero, and someone who's put me up for a sleepover in times of need, Bob Mould. Returns to the podcast. You may know him from Sugar. You may know him from Husker Du. You may know him from his solo work. You may know him from the Daily Show theme. You may know him from his work with WCW. There's a lot of places you could know Bob from, but you will know him better after this episode. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother, who is the show producer and normally guest booker extraordinaire, but I booked this one myself, Tristan Abraham. He does a fantastic job. And thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for this podcast. And he will get the message to me. You can find me on Instagram at LeftForDamian. There's a YouTube page, a TikTok page, an Instagram page, a Facebook page. I think that's it all for this podcast. All those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. And there's videos that go up for this podcast and little edits and things like that occasionally as well. So check out that stuff if you are so inclined, but you don't have to. If you just listen to this podcast right here, that's all you need. You just need the voices. You don't need the vids, but if you like the vids, check out the vids. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. We are heavily influenced by Husker Du. You can find out more information at fuckedup.cc. We are going to be playing in Yellowknife in a couple weeks. If you are there, come please say hello. If you want to travel up for that show, please come and say hello. And that's it for that. But we've got some stuff coming out, records and whatnot. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, my buddy Bob Mould is back on Turned Out of Punk. And guess what? We talk about wrestling and punk. That's all we talk about. Generally, when we get together, this is exactly what the conversations kind of sound like. There's not too many notes to give you about this episode because you know the man. He's a legend. He is one of my favorite songwriters ever. And that continues with this brand new record that he's just put out, Here We Go Crazy, which once again is a collection of awesome songs. Bob's like one of these guys that I think throughout the whole of his career, the electronic records, less so for me personally, but like even those, you can hear him there. And he's like a truly auteur songwriter, as I'm prone to throw around on this show, but this is the guy who really embodies it, and someone who not only do I have a huge passion for his music, etc., but we also share a deep love of pro wrestling, and he is someone who has seen behind the curtain. He is the Bo Jackson of the writing world for me, because he's competed at the highest levels in two of the key quote-unquote sports for me, which is punk rock and pro wrestling. Writer in punk rock and a writer in pro wrestling. Anyway, I'm excited for you to hear this. There's not too much more for me to say. Check out this brand new record Bob has. It's coming out on March 7th. As I say, like I could go track by track and tell you every song that I love on this thing, but I love this whole album. He's someone who's never disappointed me as a fan of his music, and that continues. He will be going on tour. He's got some dates in March coming up. I think those might be some release show type things. But then he's going to be going on tour with Jason and John, two friends of this show, two legends, two of the greatest rhythm players going, and together they make one of the greatest power trios I've ever seen in my life. I got to perform with them a couple times too, and every time it's a, oh my God, it's a thrill for me. Anyway, not enough about me. You're going to hear more of me in a second. Sit back, relax, and check out Bob Mould on Turned Out of Punk. Bob, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Yay, thank you for having me back, Damien. Good to chat with you.
Well, it's great to chat with you too. I feel like we've had some epic hangs, including a sleepover since the last time you were on the show.
Oh my God, right. Oh, the sleepover. Desert hang.
The desert hang where you saved me from after I missed a flight from having to camp out at the airport. So you and Don, oh. I owe you a debt for life for that.
Oh, that's so sweet. That was a bittersweet hang, if I recall.
Yeah, like it definitely was a night that, you know, we were having so much fun and then turned tragic because you got a text that came through saying that Taylor had passed away, Taylor Hawkins. And it definitely turned the night for us, I think.
Yeah, it was, that was insane. Yeah, we were just chilling. We were waiting for food. I forgot that it was Thursday night. And in Palm Springs, if you order delivery from a restaurant downtown on Thursday night, you're not going to get it because they close the main street for like a street fair. So we were ordering food and then we're thinking about more food. And then I got that text and we were like, is this for real? And you were looking up stuff on your phone and then you were like, oh shit. And I was like, oh no. And then we, yeah, it was wild.
It was wild. It definitely... I feel like Taylor's passing obviously has been very much talked about by a lot of people. So I'm not going to add anything new to the conversation other to say that he was someone, as we talked about that night, that I think I knew probably the least out of all the guys in the Foo Fighters, but never ever betrayed anything but being the sweetest, most kind human being to me. Anytime I ran into him on that tour or after or subsequently, he was always such a great person.
Yep. Sweetest guy. Always, always he'd see you, just arms out, coming in for a hug, big hug, all the time. So excited. Always asking how you doing? How's everything? You know, he was such a family guy. And I mean, that's not even like his chops and like his work stuff, which was incredible because I, you know, back in 2011, when Foo Fighters put out Wasting Light, they had me out on the road for some shows to get up and guest on Dear Rosemary, the song that I went down and recorded with them. And, you know, just what an awesome guy, great musician. And one thing that I remember, like in 2014, when me, John Jason, put out Beauty and Ruin, and we got a call, you know, as TV is, for people who don't know, sometimes you try for months to get on TV and it doesn't happen. Sometimes you're on the wait list and then you get the quick upgrade, like you have 20 minutes to decide. And we had one of those with Kimmel, and John Worster was on the road drumming with Mountain Goats, and it was such a drag that he couldn't do it. But then I'm like, but we got to do this. And somebody mentioned Taylor and I reached out and he was like, I'd love to do it. And we ran through the two songs maybe three or four times on the set for blocking. And he was, I mean, he's incredible musician. And he's just like, is that right? Is that right? Am I doing it right? Am I doing it right? I'm just like, dude, you're killing it more every time you do it. It's just so great. Just do exactly what you're doing. So, I mean, that's, I mean, I miss him a bunch. I miss him a bunch. He's a great soul.
Was he a Husker Du fan? Because I think I remember him talking about, like, he's like, yeah, I wasn't that deep into punk, but there were certain bands I really liked. I think I remember him saying you guys were one of them.
Sugar.
Oh, that makes more sense.
Yep. He's Sugar. Yep. That was the jam. Copper Blue was the jam.
Well, not to, you know, dwell too much on people that pass, but I think certainly since that time, it really drives home like how special those moments that you get with people are, like that slumber party night was, like as tragic as losing Taylor certainly Turn the Night. Prior to that, where you're showing me Kenny Omega in a Guy Madden film, like that is something I will treasure for the rest of my fucking life.
What was the name of that Sissy Boy Slap Fight or something?
Sissy Boy Slap Fight. And I feel like I have subsequently brought that to the larger world. And I cannot, like, Guy Madden is one of the greatest filmmakers to ever come into Canada. And it's sadly a very short list of great Canadian filmmakers, but he is very much at the top of it. And to see him with the greatest, in my opinion, I know your opinion might differ a little bit on this subject, and yours is a much more informed opinion than mine. One of the greatest wrestlers to ever come out of Canada. Like, that to me is peanut butter and chocolate coming together.
Yeah. No, that was when I got wise to that flick that we're talking about, I couldn't believe it. I'm just looking at it going, man, this is like out of bounds. And you know, I mean, somebody, I mean, why don't, you know, I think there's a program there, the Sissy Boy Slap Fight, you know, across three pay-per-views for AEW, don't you think?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Sissy Boy Slap Fight on a scaffold.
Well, it's amazing because then you go and see some of the work he was doing in DDT at that time, and you could see how, like, yeah, Sissy Boy Slap Fight is very much in keeping with the DDT professional wrestling aesthetic.
Yeah, it all makes sense when you see the film, then you see the DDT stuff, and then you know the progression through to New Japan, and now to Jacksonville. He's definitely one of the best professional wrestlers of his generation, and surely one of the best out of Canada, I would say.
One of the things that I saw recently that, you know, because I'm always looking for punk wrestling connections as I force you to talk about all the time. You and the Hipsters had a death match wrestling show together.
Oh, yeah, that was it. That was the poster. It was so the Hipsters were a Twin Cities band back in the day. And I think Bill and Ernie Batson, the brothers, still have Mighty Mofos up and running. But the Hipsters and Husker Du played together one night, and we billed it as a death match. And we had, you know, there were friends of ours that would go to all the shows, and they would do wrestling stuff in the mosh pit. So it was, you know, sort of a perfect billing and a perfect angle to get people in the building.
Did Jesse ever see people do, like Jesse the Body Ventura, when he was coming to the shows, did he ever see anyone do wrestling moves in the pit?
Jesse used to come to Goofy's Upper Deck and hang out.
But, okay, so different.
So he's probably certainly seen some slam dancing. That is for sure. And Jesse's back now. Good grief.
He is. He is like one of these people that I think will, I don't know, like he seems like he ages better as the years go by with wrestling fans.
Yeah, back in the day, well, late 80s, I guess, when WWF at the time got Saturday Night's Main Events on NBC, they've just started redoing that. So they've had a couple of them, and he's the, you know, special color commentator for I think they do the intro, and then he does a match or two. He doesn't do the whole show. He's pretty good still at it. He's sharp. He's good. I like Jess. He's a good guy.
And I rewatched Predator recently, and he's a damn fine actor too. Like, I think he doesn't get brought up enough in that conversation as being one of the great wrestling Hollywood crossovers.
Yeah, I think Jesse and Roddy, you know, they live was great. So yeah, good guy. He was, and you know, he had his gym up in Northeast Minneapolis, and all of those 80s big boys came out of there. You know, Road Warriors, Nikita, I think Darso, all those guys. It was it was like a meat machine up there.
It's interesting because it's like obviously a pro wrestling hotbed in the same way that it's a music hotbed. Like, as you're saying, like for a given time, anybody who's anybody came through, obviously, the AWA, but that's like really where they found themselves, it seems.
Well, it was AWA, but it was also Eddie Sharkey, who was a nemesis of Vern Gagne, who ran the AWA. And Eddie found a lot of these guys, like, you know, like bouncing at motorcycle bars up in Northeast Minneapolis, and they'd be at Jesse's gym. So Eddie ran indie shows, and I mean, that's where Sean Waltman got in. That's where Jerry Lynn got in. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of crossover in the 80s with the rock and wrestling, you know, in the Twin Cities, well before Super Clash and the Rock and Wrestling Connection video.
It's interesting when, like, you look at wrestling and sort of like the last, I don't know, 10 years, maybe it's a little bit longer, this period where it started becoming not just guys that looked really good or guys that were really tough that would be found out to be wrestlers, but it was fans of wrestling, it seemed, that found their way into their business a lot more. And it reminds me of like what, well, not reminds me of, it's similar, I think, to what happens with punk rock and rock and roll, where it's like no longer are these people cast down from the heavens like Kiss. Like these are like anyone can do it and you can find your own way into this business.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, in the 80s with the guys that had, you know, access to chemicals and they got gigantic and huge, and there was that, you know, Hogan Warrior, that, you know, Nikita Road Warriors, that whole stretch of time. And then, you know, it started to ease away from that, I guess. What was that, Sean and Brett, maybe 94? You know, I think about wrestling when it made that transition. I was big into New Japan, All Japan, All Japan Women. You know, I was going out to the mall, to the Johan Plaza in Edgewater, New Jersey, buying my wrestling VHS tapes because I could figure out Puro Resu, you know, those four characters. I was like, I'll buy that tape. And, you know, I mean, as a wrestling fan, I, you know, would see all the, you know, junior heavyweights and, you know, then, you know, it's like Sean and Brett, you know, Ray, yeah, Chris, Eddie, those guys when Heyman brought them in. Yeah, that was, I guess, that opened up the door for, you know, smaller guys, faster guys, not just body guys. And then I think that's when, maybe after that is when it started to open up. The indies were, you know, big and look, you know, the indies were popular and they were looking for bodies and, you know, like any size bodies, just guys that could work. And is that where it feels like things started to open up, like 97, 98?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's the death of ECW, and like ECW is almost like the proto-punk, the Stooges and the Velvets all rolled into one. And then it dies, and then in its wake, where you have CZW, ROH, and Chikara kind of representing sort of this artsy weirdo version of pro wrestling, with Chikara this super hardcore, no frills, a lot of violence, a lot of blood and guts, with CZW, and this sort of like higher art aspiration, pure ROH strong style type indie stuff that's coming out with that stuff. And I feel like those three is really where, yeah, it opens up.
You know, I just had the greatest thought, because it's sort of like if ECW is like the trunk of the tree and all these branches came off of it. Do you know that company, is it Dorothy in the UK that does those schematics?
Yeah, the rock trees.
Somebody should do that. Somebody should get a hold of them and do like a wrestling one, right?
Oh man, that'd be awesome. Yes. Well, I think
there was FMW.
Well, you're where I became obsessed with the idea of punk and wrestling having this deeper connection. And I thought it was a revolutionary thing that I was stumbling upon, but then I found hardcore wrestling fanzine and realized that you guys were onto this shit as it was happening.
Yeah, I was on it pretty early. Well, I mean, with wrestling, I mean, I grew up with it as a kid. I you know, grew up watching, you know, the promotional war in Montreal. I, you know, then I started getting New York stations so I could see, or, you know, earlier WWF. And yeah, and then I went to the Twin Cities. I got back into it as an active fan. And that's how I eventually got smart to the business and met people in the business. And then many years later, ended up in the business. But hardcore wrestling was a fanzine. It was people who loved me, who loved punk music and pro wrestling. And it was a little ahead of its time, I think.
Oh, definitely. Like, that's something that should be reprinted at this point, I think. Because, like, you look at where wrestling's at now with Brody King, CM Punk, Darby Allin, like, I could MVP, like, I could go on.
Punk, yeah, is Robbie, you know, all those guys, you know, yeah. Zach. Yeah. Zach is a big, yeah.
Zach Sabre Jr., you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. He had an Infest ripoff logo t-shirt.
Awesome. You know who cracks me up is, do you think Hiromu Takahashi knows any of the bands that are on his jacket?
I wonder that all the time. But there's that guy, Daisuke Sasaki, who wrestles in DDT, and he's a huge hardcore punk fan.
It all fits together. Well, Jerry Lynn, when I was talking about Minnesota, he was at First Avenue for some Husker shows.
Oh, that's awesome. I've always wondered, because people have always told me he's a metal guy, but I'm like, he's got to be into other stuff than that.
He's into like the heavy, that kind of metal, but he would be at First Ave. He was cool. I think Jerry was an accountant before he got into wrestling.
That's awesome. Well, he's like one of those guys that, you know, like you're saying, predates the explosion that happens, and is really like one of those guys. Like, I remember going to see him wrestle in small clubs up here in Toronto, and there was just like, he was like an independent guy that you had to go see wrestle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Jerry was great. Well, I mean, he and Sean, you know, were sort of, you know, they worked with each other so much. Like, didn't they, I mean, they started together in Minnesota, I think. And then did Sean went to Florida to get finished up. And then I think they may have ended up in Global, End of the Sportatorium era.
That makes sense.
And they were working each other there. And then that's, I think, when everybody saw them. And that was, I think, did Sean go? He went right from Dallas to New York, I want to say. I can't remember for sure. He was probably doing some Japan indies as well, I would bet. But yeah.
He was under a mask in Japan, I think, for a little bit too. Because I remember having him on a tape. And then the other day, we were actually just me and the guys from the Hallucination, who we were talking about earlier, were watching like Bret the Hitman Hart versus 1-2-3 Kid when he first came in as, and they brought him in so well, like they brought him in perfectly as a fan of it. I bought that hook, line and sinker.
Yeah, that was so great. I mean, you know, they used to do variations of that. You know, like from the crowd, was it like Outback Jack or, you know, stuff like they bring here, but the way they brought Sean in was great. And that was probably, well, that was when Scott Hall, Kevin Nash had power or had sway, I guess.
And it feels like that's such a callback to sort of the original days of the carnival, where you'd go out and be like, okay, who in the crowd can take on this man? And the little guy would step up and somehow beat the champion. Like, it's such a hallmark of pro wrestling.
Oh my God. It's great. Well, I mean, that's where the term comes from, right? Marks.
Yes.
So that's the thing. It's like, for people who don't know pro wrestling, they hear fans now using terms, you know, like kayfabe or marks or whatever. All that stuff is carnival, because if I'm not mistaken, back in the traveling circus carnival, pro wrestling, tough man shows up in town and they call out and $100 to anybody in the crowd that can beat him, blah, blah, blah. And they do the program, right? He'd mop a guy, mop another guy. And then the third guy was the ringer, his working buddy, who'd hold him to a draw. And then they have to charge people to come see the real match. And the promoters would go around and put chalk on people's backs, like an X. It was like, there's a mark.
Yeah, you knew who to call in for all the carnival rides and everything if they had that little white mark on them.
Yeah. So yep. So that's where Mia's art came from.
Well, and it's funny too, because that, like, it goes so deep, that approach to pro wrestling. Or Robbie Brookside, when he was on the podcast, he said when he was breaking in, and this is like, you know, late 70s, they would still go out at the end of the night and be like, who in the crowd wants to fight one of these wrestlers? And it would be like drunken sailors that he'd have to fight as a 17-year-old kid. And that's why they had to have all those holds. They had to have the sugar holds so they could get out of the situations with those guys.
Yes, indeed. I mean the businessman, it used to be tough guys, really tough guys. I mean, when everybody believed, I mean, that was the whole thing with like NWA, or especially with Watts. Guys in Mid-South, if you got in a bar fight and you even got a scuff, you might lose your job. He always had super tough guys. And that was like with the NWA, with the traveling champ. You know, I think up until Flair, all those guys were shooters, like Dory, Jack Briscoe, Harley, fuck, you know?
And it still happens, right? Like, it's still like, that's what I think, it's such a, I think that's part of the thrill for people, and not that it's should be, you know, viewed for this sort of level of excitement, but I think it's almost like a car crash, I guess, for auto racing fans with less deadly results. But there's always that tension, like at any moment this could turn and these guys could stop working together and start working against each other. And I think when wrestling plays with that and gets people to believe, that's when you can tell the magic's still
yep. there. Absolutely. 100%. 100%. And that's where I have a problem with the modern product, because it's real, you know, it's really amazing choreographed gymnastics and tumbling and stories. And, you know, everybody's got to be a character, and, you know, and people expect good, fast work. But I miss the days of like, oh shit, something just happened. Mm-hmm. because that's the stuff that actually sells tickets in the old days, where people like in Florida, where everybody would be like, yeah, all of it's fake, but Dusty Rhodes, that's real.
Oh, and it still would sell tickets. Like, if you could get Jack Perry and CM Punk in a ring anywhere in the world, that's a sellout.
Yeah, I know. Well, man, did AEW mess that all up or what?
I think there's a lot of things AEW can be blamed for. I don't know if I give them all the blame on that one for personally, but once again, I wasn't in there and I haven't been, you know, behind the rope like you have. So I don't really know, but that's what my take on it would be.
I have a hard time understanding, even if there's that much real heat, they sort of isolated Punk, right? He said, give me Collision, give me the Saturday show, let me book it like a wrestling show. And that show was doing really good numbers, and he didn't have to interact with the guys in the back that he had heat with. He was building his own crew. They were doing really good numbers. Tickets were, you know, the tickets were still hot. And then boom, that happened at their biggest show ever. And what's the biggest house they've done since Wembley?
Yeah, you know, you're right. Like, it definitely.
That's the part where I'm just like, but I get it, because I mean, I was right in the middle of the uprising in 2000. So, you know, it's hard to predict, right?
Yeah, and that's, I think, the thing is, right? Like, that's the only thing that's, I guess, is comparable to is the uprising, where, like, what do you do in that situation? And obviously, you were there, and you talk about it in the book, the way Kevin kind of had to handle it, or the way he chose to handle it. And it's like, and it's amazing to think of how different maybe the war would have turned out if you guys had been able to work with those guys. And I mean, Kevin.
Yeah. Kevin and Chris and Eddie and all those guys. Yeah. Yeah, that was nuts. I mean, that was that whole, I was just so stressed out for a whole week after that. And then it was like, you know, Kevin and JJ are like, you got to snap out of this. It's Thursday and we got TV on Monday. Let it go. I mean, I was like, what can we do? Let's talk to Bill Bush. How about we just don't let those guys go. Let them take Big Goldie over to New Japan and go ahead and tell people what's on your mind. I mean, that was what I wanted to do. It's like, let them, you know, and then we got something after Cooler Heads Prevail, but I couldn't sell that one.
Which is would have been amazing too, because that I think at that time would have really played into kind of the early internet fervor that was building up around these guys. And that's where ultimately, like, when you look at the Summer of Punk stuff, like that was, I think, the last truly effective angle where just people believed and people bought in, because it played with what people wanted from wrestling in the same way that that would have played with what people want from wrestling today.
It's that thing. It's the water cooler stuff, right? When you go to work and everybody's like, "Did you hear about this wrestling thing?" Where like there was this guy and they made him champ and then he quit. He went to Japan. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that get, you know, that gets people talking. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know Punk personally, but just to put a period on that whole thing, I just can't believe they let that they let him go over that. Because I don't know. I mean, Scott Steiner. I don't know. I'm just saying out loud.
Yeah, like I think it's also because like he's used to, you know, and I mean Tony Khan when I say this, but like he's used to managing professional sports teams. And I think wrestling, once again, as you know better than me, is unlike any other business on earth.
There is nothing like it. There's nothing like it. It's all of the swagger and meat of professional sports mixed with all of the frailties and insecurities of stage actors.
Yes.
And then when you put the carny on it, it's like, okay, how do we negotiate all this stuff?
Yeah, like it's interesting, and I think it's changing, and probably has changed even since I was kind of around it, you know, 10 years ago. But it's the distrust is so baked in to the business. Like you're meant to distrust the fans, you got to distrust the promoter, you got to distrust the guy, everyone you got to distrust except for that person you're in the ring with during that time who you have to put all your trust in.
You got 100% trust who you're giving your body to, but all the rest of the day is what's in it for me? You know, if I do this, what do I get next month? I mean, you've been in the back. You have a good sense of all that horse trading that goes on to get even just to get a finish out of a match. Or it's people can't imagine. I mean, you know, I know people hear about it, but unless you're like there seeing it and feeling it and what it does to the whole back of the building, you know, when somebody's like, "That don't work for me, brother."
Yes. And it's like and I say this with all the love in the world for the art form and the sport of professional wrestling, but the sketchiest person that you will meet in punk rock will be amongst the most honorable people you will meet in pro wrestling.
Wow. That's like you just did like a Norm Dooley. You just invented a whole new, you know, star system.
It's funny because like when Doyle was on the podcast, like the whole time, you know, he's talking about different fights he's been in, but he got the look of respect on his face when he talked about pro wrestling and how tough those guys are and how scary those guys are. And this is before I knew about the Macho Man stuff with him, but it really is like true that this is like a business where you're dealing with people that could punch you in the face if you give them bad creative. Like historically, people have been punched in the face for giving bad creative.
I didn't go in the finish room.
Yes.
I just sat a gorilla and told people to speed it up, slow it down, hit them again. You got to get to break, wrap it up. Come on. You know, Jeff Jarrett over my shoulder. What's my line? You know, he's gonna say blah blah blah. Music, go.
He's got to be the greatest professional wrestler of all time, Jeff Jarrett, because he is once again on another run.
What a survivor! I mean, he
Incredible.
knows. I mean, it's the family business. He for a long time. Jeff's a really good guy. I have nothing but good things to say about Jeff. I enjoyed working with him. He's very professional, very courteous. I was, I was in over my head, and he was always pleasant to me and helpful. And yeah, good guy.
Yeah, and like when I said that about the sketchy thing, I should preface that there are some of the greatest people I've ever met in pro wrestling. And Kevin Sullivan, I think I have very limited experiences with him, but every experience I did have with him, he was always a really sweet guy to me.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin was one of the, I think the first time that I met Kevin Sullivan was 91. And he was in Philly, and I can't remember if it was one of Gary Jester's WCW shows, or if it was when Todd Gordon was doing Eastern Championship Wrestling.
Oh, yeah.
But my partner at the time and I had just gotten back from doing like 10 shows with Dinosaur Jr. in the Netherlands and playing with Nirvana at festivals. This is 91 against summer. And getting back to the States and going to Philly and meeting Kevin and Nancy and just hanging out with them. And I said something about Amsterdam. They're like, "Oh, did you bring anything back from Amsterdam?" Like, well, I just happen to have this right here. Well, we just happen to have this room up here. And a friendship was born, and then fast forward 8 years, and I'm side by side with Sullivan for my whole run there.
The Great Uniter canvas.
Oh,
Truly is.
I miss Kevin Sullivan so much. He is truly one of the best people I've met in my life. He was really just so wise and so kind and so thoughtful, despite everything that people think, and from his persona or what the opposition says about him ever since then. No, he's what an amazing soul. He taught me so much about wrestling and about life, and I miss him terribly.
Rest in peace to him because, yeah, like I met him towards the end of his life, and every conversation I had with him, he was just, you could tell he loved not just the business, but loved the fact that people loved wrestling. And he would be at like shitty little indie shows, and it would still, like, he's obviously not doing it for a payday.
He loves the business, and I mean all the I mean all of the great minds of the television era taught him so much, and he learned from Vince Senior, Eddie Graham. I mean, the whole foundation of the wrestling that you and I grew up on, these storylines and these finishes and these programs. For him to, I mean, he would tell me those stories about, being a young boy up in New York and going to Vince Senior and saying, "I want to learn how to do this." And he would tell me that, like, Vince Senior would sit down with him with the book and say, "Here's how I do this." That's pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, like I don't know if Vince Senior did that ever with Vince Junior.
I don't know. I
I don't know for sure either way, but I've always
who knows? But
one thing I want to ask you about. You never worked with Eric Bischoff, right? You guys never crossed paths at WCW.
nope. He went out, I came in. I went out, he came back.
It's crazy because I've heard him do this, and I don't want to cause drama or stir shit up, but like I've heard him multiple times talk about you. Like people be like, "Oh, Bob Mould, blah, blah, blah," and he's like, "Yeah, like he was just there for a brief time. Didn't he didn't do much, blah, blah, blah." I'm like, "You weren't there when he was there. What the fuck are you talking about?"
Nope, they sent him home. They called me. I went home. He came back. We've actually never met. He did great. He had a really good run there. I mean, my thing with Eric is just strictly as a fan or an observer, I guess, was I remember him from Ninja Stars, selling toy stuff, like timeshares on AWA wrestling, and then he held the stick for promos and He really did a lot, you know, when he went to Atlanta. He did, you know, that's pretty hell of a run. And he is correct. I didn't do that much, but we've never met.
Well, that's the thing. He wasn't even there. Like, he's like,
He
and
wasn't
I,
even there.
yeah, he doesn't even know about the music. Like, his also, his assessment of Husker Du always pisses me off too. So
Oh,
maybe I'm the one
Eric's
who's been,
assessment of Mr. Do.
yeah, like he's like, oh yeah, like what? He was in some college rock band. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, you don't even know about this band. Anyway, I should be cutting a promo on him.
Stay in your lane.
Oh my God, absolutely, like.
Sorry. I like Bob Seger too, but I do know more about music than that. Anyhow.
That's the one thing I think about pro wrestling. Like, we've never seen like a wrestling company being run like any other creative thing out there, where it's not necessarily run by the performers. It's run by sort of like a hive mind of different creatives. And I think that you're starting to see that with WWE, where I think it's now shifting to a hive mind of other creative type format. But for years, it's kind of been run by the wrestlers, which is just so unlike any other type of entertainment out there.
Yeah, I will say WWE's product is on fire, and what I'm loving about it is, you know, remember the era where Stephanie had like 25 Hollywood writers, and the whole thing was it just didn't resonate with me as a wrestling fan. So now they've got people working, you know, Hunter's got people working that are, you know, sort of treating it like sport. Like now they're really into statistics, and this is the 14th event here. And you know, 2 years ago, these two guys in this blood feud that are coming up, they wrestled here 3 years ago. And it's like they're going back to their own history, like short-term history for sure. And it just makes the product shine and sit so much better. It's really
Oh,
cool.
yeah, because I think now they're listening to these people. Like, I'm sure, like, these Hollywood writers, like, we hear, like, Freddie Prinze Jr. and all these people talk about how, like, they could come up with the greatest ideas in the world, but ultimately, it would not make it to air.
Don't work for me, brother.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez.
It is like a moment where I wish I had bought WWE stock a couple years ago when it felt like it was so undervalued as an entertainment commodity versus now where it's on Netflix and it's got like a lot more of a higher profile.
The Netflix thing is crazy. I mean, I'm, yeah, you know, there's just the world has changed, right? You know, I mean, you know, the politics in America has changed, and it's just sort of like where, you know, sort of like somebody dumped out a, you know, bag of jacks, and where did everything land? And WWE, lo and behold, because of, you know, time, place, situation, have ended up being this huge, you know, worldwide entertainment complex, which, you know, I'm okay without the stock, thanks.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, not on a moral level, I wish I had bought stock, but for my children's future,
Yeah.
I wish I had bought stock. It's,
Yeah.
do you think there could be, like, at this point, anything, like, given something, nothing catastrophic happening to the company, I mean, but, like, could someone rise up and become the new number one at this point, or is it just too far gone? Because I think at different points, like WCW time or even moments in the post WCW era, I think it was vulnerable that if there was like a competently run number two, that it could have overtaken it, and maybe AEW in the beginning too.
AEW had a chance until Wembley. No, I don't think anybody's going to touch it. It's so far beyond. I mean, they've saturated, you know, the internet with content. You know, if it's Netflix, if it's YouTube, if it's Tubi now, they've got Evolve starting on Tubi. They're ubiquitous. You can't. It's now when you. As it has been in the past, when you say wrestling, everybody goes, "Oh, WWE." They've moved, you know, they've been migrating away from cable television, you know, and just going to streaming. they're so far ahead. Nobody's going to catch up for a long time. And I don't know. It's funny. One of the things that I learned at WCW, and I think it was the late Mike Graham said, I think it was when Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara and Bill Banks and Terry Taylor came down from New York to Atlanta, and he just said, "I'll tell you how this is going to go. If they come down and they do this stuff, Vince and New York are going to go in the other direction, and they're still going to win." And it's almost as if AEW is so far, it got so far gone and so wild, and so many, barbed wire, glass, balconies, juice every week. And WWE's just gone, they're back to walk and talk. Walk and talk, beauty shot, shoulder block, but drop down tackle, clothesline over the top. Don't fall on your back, monster. Stay on your feet. Walk around, get heat, come in 25 minutes. Yeah. It's wild. They've gone sort of back to the basic storytelling.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's interesting with wrestling too, where every time there's a new company that starts, it always tries to present itself like WWE presents itself in terms of like how it's shot, the way people come to the ring, the music. It's like if post Minor Threat coming out, everyone had just wanted to sound like Minor Threat and just tried to sound like Minor Threat. Like there's just it just doesn't make sense to me when there is a band doing this. Like, why would you want to sound like them? And I say that as a
Exactly.
band that sounds a lot like Husker Du, so I fully admit that.
Well, no, but I mean, it's one, there's always, DNA and everything that we do, but like the sort of front face of a wrestling company to try to emulate that, it's like there's already that. You need to be an alternative to that. And don't get me wrong, I'm not bashing on AEW because if they succeed, more of the guys have work. That's always what you want, is bigger, more jobs for wrestling people. But man, yeah, it's, I don't know, WWE just sort of grabbed it again. I just watched New Beginnings, the New Japan pay-per-view from last weekend, I think.
They've gotten
It,
good again.
it's it's they're they're re, they're in the rebuild, right?
Yeah. But it feels like it's, I don't know, like it felt like there was, I shouldn't say they're not, they're, like you're saying, they're rebuilding because there was some stuff at that New Year's Eve or the was it January 4th show?
Wrestle
Wrestle
Kingdom, yeah.
Kingdom, where watching it, I'm like, oh my gosh, this reminds me of, 2009. Kind of excitement for this product. But then there's other stuff where it feels like, oh yeah, it's not quite at that level of excitement it would hit a few years later with Kenny Omega versus Okada.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, Kenny and Okada, that was the peak, and Ospreay underneath, and Naito was still pretty hot. I mean, and they had a lot, they had a lot of a lot they had a deep roster. You know this, and most, longtime wrestling fans know the problem right now is with any company, you to make a star, you got to have a star that'll make a star. So I guess, I always think about ECW and when Heyman got a hold of Terry Funk, and the goal was to make stars with Terry Funk, and he came in and he made stars out of all those guys.
Yeah.
So I look at AEW now and I'm like, who there can make a star?
Yeah, like it's interesting what they did with Sting during that last Sting run
So
where
amazing.
it was great, but then in the end, and I remember talking like I'm like to Darby, like you got to turn on him. You got to turn on him. He's like, "No, we can't. We're not going to I'm not going to never going to turn on this guy." But
No,
I'm
you
like,
can't.
that's what Like that's the way that you make someone, I feel like, more. But I don't, once again, like this is just coming from a fan's perspective. But yeah, you need, and also like who could you sign right now that would elicit the excitement on the level that these people they've signed already have. Like, there's no one really out
there. There's nobody left. And, you know, it's funny because AEW signed away all the top shelf of New Japan, and they're in this rebuild, and they don't have many guys that can give blood. So it's sort of like it's going to be harder for them to build stars because Okada's not there to get blood. Osprey's not there to get blood. So it's like who in New Japan in the top shelf can get these guys over right now?
I guess Tanahashi, right?
He's on his retirement tour. Yeah. Naito's just about wrapped, you know, and then there's a pretty steep drop after that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's
so no... the rebuild is going to be really tough, but they're doing good. I mean, they got a lot. I mean, Gabe Kidd is crazy. Oh my God. He's like almost 300 now. He's starting to look like Vader. And he's nuts. He's out of his fucking mind.
Yeah. It's still like, and it's just something, I guess, about being in Japan as a wrestler that just allows people to find, not always, but like in many cases, allows people to find who they really are and their character. I guess because you're working in front of a crowd that doesn't speak the language necessarily, so you have to come up with new ways to connect with people. But
yeah, you got to use your body. You got to do. It's like the thing when you're, you know, it's like the Lawler is a heel thing in the 70s, right? When he goes into his trunks and he pulls out the chain and he parades it around up in the air. It's when you don't use language, you got to use all that body language. So I think when the guys go to Japan, they got to, you know, and you, like, I've never been down to Mexico City. Is it like that down there where like the American guys have to learn all the, you know, sort of the lucha theatrics and projection and everything?
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Definitely, but I think like I found like maybe in Mexico City it was different, and maybe I didn't see enough American guys cut. No, I definitely saw some American guys cut promos there. Like, I think people speak the language more, or at least respond to the language more than they do in Japan when guys are cutting promos, or there's certain words guys can throw in, or certainly mannerisms. Like at the time, El Hijo de Trump was the main heel. Right. And so he comes out of the ring and it really elicits a response right out of the gate. And I think there was like some other guys that I saw down there that were cutting at times very racist promos. I think there's certain types of things you can do in Mexico in the ring that you would not get away with, even in the most sort of outlaw of indies in America at this point. So guys were relying on that stuff a little bit.
Yeah, I mean that's an age old wrestling trope that, you know, post war wrestling. I mean, a lot of the wrestling in Japan after World War II, you know, when they, you know, when it made it over there, and you know, that it was like a constant, you know, it was Ricky Dozan and a steady diet of foreign monsters, American heels, and you know, in America it was, you know, you know, the evil Germans, the evil Japanese, you know, just any exotic, you know, exotic sort of post-war, you know, 1950s characters. So it's a weird trope.
Yeah. And it's something that I think that's why people underestimate how political wrestling is, like, because you're saying you can play out these greater societal storylines in the ring in a way that, like, we can write songs about something, but we can't play it out in the same way that a wrestling match can kind of play it out like a play would, but people respond to it like it's a rock show.
Do you think that wrestling could go back to, not that I'm into that kind of trope, but now that the curtain has been fully opened to the business being 100% cooperative physical entertainment. Would that move pro wrestling to the same place as, like a series on HBO where those kind of touchy subjects get addressed? I don't know if that can happen.
It's yeah, you're right, because it's interesting, because when someone becomes a bad guy in wrestling, they become a bad guy in real life, because the line between reality and what's in the ring is so blurred, I feel like. Like there's very few people that have gone heel in wrestling in real life that I feel like are just working the audience in that kind of way. Or if they are, it's very over the top, where you can kind of tell, like, okay, this is what this guy's doing. But when anyone goes on and says something scary or horrific politically, it's sadly not a work most of the time, I find.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, I don't know. I got wise to the wrestling heels are the nice guys, and wrestling baby faces are sort of not the nice guys. I learned that at a young age as a fan in my small farm town when wrestling came to the high school, and I snuck down to the dressing room and got asked to leave really quick, but waited around to get autographs at the end. And Gino Brito, the Montreal baby face, blew me off. And then Hans Schmidt, the French Canadian German heel of the 50s television, had all the time in the world for me. I was like, oh, I get it. Oh, man.
Do you know Shane Carter from, he's in tons of bands from New Zealand. He was in the Board Games. He was in, fuck, I'm trying to think of what his band that crossed over a little bit in America was called. Straight Jackets, maybe. But anyway, in his book, he talks about going to the show and having the exact same experience and meeting Abdullah the Butcher, and Abdullah the Butcher being the nicest guy in the world to him.
Oh, that's good. He didn't blade him, did
No, he said,
he? Here, come on, let me look at your forehead real close.
definitely. I think that's maybe the only guy in wrestling that it's better to be meet as a fan than as a wrestler, maybe.
Yep. Zip. Whoa, what happened?
Was that hardcore wrestling thing, and like, how did that come together? Was this through guys traveling, meeting each other, kind of realizing who was and wasn't into wrestling?
Yeah, it would just be we'd all be we would just be talking at shows and wrestling would come up. It'd be a lot of the it was like Ohio, I think, were most of those guys. Dave Hansen, and I'm trying to remember some of the other names there. It's escaping me, but yeah, it was just people that were in the sort of the hardcore scenes, because I think that issue, it was like wrestling, and then it was like Toxic Reasons and Husker Du and the Adolescents or so. It was this crazy mishmash,
Well,
but it
because the
was
guys.
mostly I think it was mostly Midwest guys who were into hardcore, and you're hanging out and talking gets to wrestling, and then you get to putting out a hybrid fanzine.
Because the I think the guys from Stretch Marks have something written in there too, if I'm not mistaken, or was one of the contributors.
Yes, and they were Winnipeg, right?
It feels like that kind of kept going too, this sort of like underground network within the underground network of punk, of like wrestling fans, like be it the guys from H100s, who I think it was Tony Erba that first told me, from the H100s and Nine Shocks Terror, that you were writing for WCW way back when. So it was, but then you guys played a show with Rancid Vat too, and I know they've got like a Rule Breakers, and they've got Ric Flair on the cover of one of their records and stuff, so they were wrestling fans too.
Do you know much about Mad Garden, Phoenix?
Oh, that's on the cover of This Is Phoenix, Not LA, right?
Yeah, Madison Square Garden, the little 1500, 2000 cap building in the corner of nowhere in Phoenix, and they left the ring up, and everybody, the punk rock shows, you played in the ring, and there was a cage between the ring and where the crowd was, like a permanent cage wall,
Oh, that's
and people would,
awesome.
and it shows people would climb the cage and dive off. It was in fucking, it was so insane. That was like JFA Meat Puppets that back then, I think, was.
Well, and Conflict too, who you played with a couple times, I think. Love that band.
Yeah, the punk rock and wrestling have been good friends for a long time.
Yeah. And I think it's because both are kind of subverting their forms a little bit. Like punk is subverting rock music, and in the same way, wrestling's subverting sports in a way.
Yeah,
And
and like you were saying before, where wrestling now has become when it started to open up to, fans of with knowledge or fans who wanted to get in the business. That's where it maybe didn't look like hardcore punk rock meets pro wrestling in the 80s, but it felt more like that. Where like you're saying, if you got the drive and you want to get into it, there's an open door there all of a sudden.
I think it's like Colt Cabana that kind of, will say, and he's kind of given credit for almost being the guy who really brought merchandising to pro wrestling on like the independent level. And he's freely admits that he got that from music. And in music, that's definitely coming from punk.
Gas money.
Yeah, exactly. And like independent wrestling, I think once it started governing itself in that kind of Colt Cabana, CM Punk era, a little bit more like music, and the way these guys were building up their own fan bases independent from a company, and they could kind of go and travel around and do shows together. I think that's where the power shifted in wrestling and stopped being as much in the hands of the companies and much more in the hands of the performers, the wrestlers.
Yeah, and it's funny with indie wrestling in that at that time, late 90s. I mean, like pro wrestling companies, if you build a big company around a star, like a Hogan or Warrior, whoever, that kind of thing, if that person doesn't do business and they walk, then your company sort of lost. The indie guys, they were like true independent contractor, protecting their gimmick, going all over the circuit. And it, I don't know, with pro wrestling, it was like the ensemble, like the brand now is, it's sort of like the brand is bigger than any one guy. Because if somebody leaves, then you're in trouble. But if the brand is good, a star can leave and you're still okay. I don't know what
And
that has to do with indie wrestling, but you know what I'm trying to say.
I know exactly what you're saying, but I think that also, like in the same way, when music got the photocopier and the cassette tape, it shifted, it democratized it in a huge way. I think when pro wrestlers had access to social media, that technology democratized that, where they didn't have to rely on a company, unless like you're obviously you're saying like Hulk Hogan leaves, everyone knows about it. But if you're like a smaller indie guy and all of a sudden you're fired, you could take your fan base with you now, and you could be like, here's where I'm going, here's where I'm going to be working this weekend, and you could build it up yourself. On you didn't need the company to build you up as much.
Yeah, you were, it was almost like a traveling champ, like you're an attraction. You can go, you could go somewhere two, three times a year instead of working a territory every week, or working on TV for a big company every week, where, they keep, performers are a little handcuffed, I suppose, in those settings. And indies, you just show up and this is what I'm doing, this is my thing, this is what I do. How are we going to do this? How are we going to do business tonight? So yeah, freelancing. It's cool.
Yeah, and that's what I think you guys built up in music. And I feel like Black Flag and a little bit DOA get a lot of, they're given a lot of credit for this thing. But I was going through, there's this amazing website that has every single show you guys ever played with flyers on it. And I'm going through that today. And I feel like you guys don't really get the credit you deserve. Certainly later on when you got bigger and kind of crossed over. But I mean, in terms of being the hardcore band that's doing that boots on the ground touring like you did and building like this North American kind of punk scene.
Yeah, but it was all. I mean, we're record store kids. We're in a punk rock band, and when the bands we loved came to town, we would do anything to get near them. We would do anything to help them. And when it was our time to hit the road, it was Ken Lester and Joey and the DOA guys. it was Biafra and Alternative Tentacles and, Tim Mohannon and the Maximum Rock and Roll people. That was how all that community got built. And then eventually we went down to SST land, or, going to Austin, Texas, Big Boys and the Dicks. And that was an incredible time. And Husker Du was the, we did what we could to help people, and there were so many people who really helped us get up and running on the road. And then it just snowballs from there. It all, like us taking Soul Asylum out for Wig Out East, it got them in front of people. And, fucking Soul Asylum at that time, what, in '85, they were just on fire. They were an amazing band. It kept us honest, so yeah, good times, good, whole different world back then.
The other day at a record store here in Toronto called The Missions, I found a test press of the first Soul Asylum single that you produced.
Oh wow, was that like tied to the tracks?
Yeah, and it was affordable and I bought it immediately. I was like, oh my God, what a day.
That's so awesome. That was one of my favorite production gigs, was working with them on Made to Be Broken. So what a great band. They were really,
Oh,
really good.
absolutely.
And it
I
was tough
feel
for
like
them because they were like 2 years younger than us in Replacements, right? So they were like, oh, the baby band. Yeah.
it's interesting because I was like going through the Reflex Records tapes and the records you guys did, and it's almost like, is that a separate scene than that Twin Tone scene at that point? Like, are you guys kind of giving a home to the bands that wouldn't fit in to the other thing, or is it just the bands that you kind of liked around then?
Husker Du started Reflex Records as a reflex to Twin Tone not being interested in Husker Du.
No, I knew that absolutely, but I mean, like in terms of the other bands you guys are working with, like be it Rifle Sports or like Final Conflict or is are
Man-Sized
these bands,
Action,
yeah, and these
Ground
bands wouldn't
Zero.
like would they don't I don't think they would have worked in the same way or would have been signed by Twin Tone, or maybe I'm putting that on.
Well, Twin Tone was three people at the time we approached them. It was Paul Stark and Charlie Hallman and Peter Jespersen. And Peter went on to manage the Replacements, and then was in the business, the probably the most active of the three in the long term in the business. And I think Twin Tone had every, all three had to like a band to sign them, and we only got two out of three. So as far as the scene that we were building with Reflex, yeah, it was bands that I don't think would have necessarily fit into the Twin Tone, railway system. I don't think they would ever got on track with them. And that's cool. I mean, that's more labels is more music for everybody. So it was cool. But yeah, we definitely were, sort of like the home for wayward young bands, I guess.
It's interesting because you guys stop Reflex the same year, or just maybe the next year, AMREP starts up. So it almost feels like that's the inheritor of it a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, Tom Hanselmeyer was definitely around helping, with Reflex. I mean, helping put the booklets together for Barefoot and Pregnant and Kitten, the cassette compilation. So I mean, yeah, Tom was around, and I am blanking on the name of Tom's first band, where he's
Todd
Todd
Luckin or something?
Lockin. Todd
Todd
Lockin.
Luckin, that's it. Yes.
Tom was a he was the singer for that band, and I think part of that band went on to be Otto's Chemical Lounge.
Yeah, I think the other he went on to do Halo of Flies and the rest of the guys did Otto's Chemical Lounge, maybe.
Yep, and then Tom had AMRAP and all the great stuff that came from that. So that yeah, it's yeah, I think AMRAP definitely. Well, AMRAP far surpassed anything Reflex did, but I think they, like you said, it was Reflex sort of got to be, more than we could do, and AMRAP definitely was at the right time.
I love those guitar tone on the guitar tone on those records, like the Ground Zero record you did, the Articles of Faith record you did, and the Final Conflict. Like, you had like a really distinct tone. I think it's even different than what you're doing with obviously your own tone around that time too.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, the thing that was sort of crazy about all those records is the kick drum, right? You know, always, you know, not, it wasn't so beefy, but it always had that point on top that cut through everything with the Husker records for sure. But I think, you know, with Made Soul Asylum, Made to Be Broken, that was that's the thing I always sort of remember is that and the, you know, just sort of the really tight gated the snare drums on things. Yeah, guitars. I mean, you know, Ground Zero. Terry was a great guitar player and had a, you know, definitely had a sound of his own. Soul Asylum. Yeah, a lot of guitars, a lot of layers of guitars.
When Impaler got named by Tipper Gore as on the naughty list, did you get any blowback? Because that record
No.
might say produced by Bob Mould in a bigger font than it says Impaler.
I think you may be right.
That's why I bought it.
Yes, that's awesome. They were nice guys. They were fun. They were living the gimmick, to be sure. No, I didn't get any blowback. I mean, it's so funny to think, you know, the guy that invented the internet was married to, you know, someone who tried to shut down modern music. It's just what a world, right?
Yes. And there's that clip of Jello Biafra debating Tipper Gore on Oprah that to me is just like that the culture should have just stopped at that time.
Yeah, that's a classic moment. That's right up there with Bill Grundy and the Sex Pistols. It's good stuff.
Yes. Going back to the hipsters, did you guys find yourselves more in line with kind of that scene, like than the Twin Tone scene, because you guys seem to play a lot of shows with that band around then.
And we were just friends with those guys, and we had some overlap in crowd, but I'm, you know, hipsters are. You know, for people who haven't heard them, or you know, like really sort of a classic
Garage
garage,
rock
you know,
type thing,
garage
yeah.
rock, yeah. And Bill Batson, front guy, you know, pressed white shirt, thin black tie, big build, physical. And Ernie used to, didn't Ernie used to get juice with his guitar?
Well, I don't know. Is that
Yeah,
true? That's
no,
awesome.
ba. Yeah, he'd be playing, and then he'd lift it up, ba, and then there's juice. Or Bill might have been. So, you know, they definitely had a wrestling thing going the hard way.
There's a live record of them that's amazing.
Yeah, they were pretty fiery. They were more garage than Husker. You know, Husker was more, you know, I mean, very early on, it was like simple, you know, first wave punk meets sort of surf beat. And then we ended up at hardcore somehow and then turned into a pop band. But hipsters, we get overlap in the crowd, but definitely different, sort of different foundations, I guess.
Well, that's what I was wondering early on, because you guys had the Farfisa and you guys had were obviously doing a little more 60s covers at that time too.
Yeah. Well, those first two shows, you know, the you know, Ron's Randolph Inn, Charlie and the Returnables.
Yeah.
You know, that by the end of the second show, it morphed into Husker Du. Like in front of absolutely 25 people.
That's one of those 25 people that, you know, a million people say they were one of them. Back then.
It. I love
What
it. I love
were
it.
the guys in Red Meat like?
I was trying to think. That was Bob Rue and those guys. Oh, they were nice guys. They were fine.
They're like one of the there's a couple bands that,
Oh,
you know,
what?
out of
No, Red
that
Meat. Was that Peter Davis? Your
I don't know, their
flesh.
lyrics are pretty abhorrent.
That might have been Peter Davis, who was from Southern California, had a fanzine called Your Flesh. Are you familiar with that
Absolutely, yeah,
publication?
of course. You guys played a show with Dwight Yoakam in New York? Two shows maybe with him?
Two Nights Irving Plaza 86, just putting out Candy Apple Gray, just signed with Warner Brothers. And Dwight had just signed with Reprise, which was part of Warner's at the time, or part of this, you know, Warner Elektra Asylum family. And the label came to us and said, "What would you think of having this up and coming country star named Dwight Yoakam open your shows at Irving Plaza?" And we just sort of were like, Yeah, let's give it a shot and see what happens. And Dwight was the nicest guy. And I remember the punks just yelling at him, play faster, play faster, play faster.
Because he had gone to shows in Southern California, right? Like he went to Black Flag shows and stuff.
I don't know this backstory. I only knew about Dwight when he was brought as a new country act on Reprise. I
Oh,
don't
that's too
know.
funny. I was wondering if he knew you guys from seeing you guys back in LA at some point. Because, yeah, I guess the story goes at one point he was in LA and was going to certainly some of those like, more sort of blood on the saddle kind of shows, but saw Black Flag and saw all that stuff.
I wouldn't doubt it, but I only, just we exchanged pleasantries and then, we were off to the next town. I don't, it was the thing, it was one of those label things, as people out there probably know, when you get with a big label or an indie label and they come, "Hey, we got this band, can you help a brother? Can you help a label out?"
Yes. The band you guys played with, The Delinquents, that was Lester Bangs' band, right? Or they backed up Lester Bangs, I think, on a record.
Perhaps you got me on that. You got me on that one. But I do remember the band, The Delinquents.
Because there's so many bands like you guys played with that I'm like, I can't believe you guys played with them. Like The Fugs. Like what you talk about in the book, playing with The Fugs, but your two worlds. And I think The Fugs are one of the uncredited proto-punk bands to me.
Well, that was Ed Sanders, right? Who was part of the whole Beat thing, and that came together in the it was like fall of 80, summer of 87. William Burroughs was living in Lawrence, Kansas, and James Grauerholz, who handled William's affairs, put together an event called River City Reunion, where he brought a lot of the Beats to Lawrence to William, and they asked two musical acts. One was the Fugs, and the other was Husker Du. So that was how that all came together. And I think Biafra was there. I think that was when he was reading his transcripts.
That's awesome.
I think he went on and on and on when he did his thing. It was wild.
That's too funny. Harley Flanagan was just on the podcast and he told me that he was a member of the Fugs for a short period in like the early 80s.
Who am I to argue with Harley?
I know, I'm just like Ginsberg put out a book by Harley when he was 8 years old, so he's got cred.
Say no more. It's legit.
Yeah. Have you heard Ginsberg's punk record?
Nope.
He's got a punk record he did with a band called Still Life from Colorado, Denver, that was on the same label as Bum Con and White Trash, who I know you played with a couple times.
Yep. I remember White Trash. That's crazy. Now I got to find this. That's there. There's a curiosity. You got me on that one. I did a little bit of time around Alan, not enough to say we were friends, but he was a character.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how many of those beat guys were kind of around punk in like obviously Burroughs, who you have direct contact with, but like even in Please Kill Me, there's talk of him being at shows.
Yeah, I mean, it was the natural. Well, I mean, it was Beats, then hippies, then punks. So, punks hate. They hate punks. It was like, "Hate the hippies," but the Beats, it's like your parents aren't cool, but your grandparents are.
Yes,
So I don't know,
yes.
that kind of thing.
Yeah, very much so. But I think also there's like a nihilistic worldview with the beat stuff that I imagine, or like certainly a realistic worldview maybe at times that
Fatalistic for sure, yeah.
definitely, which I think probably fits more in line with punk than a lot of the hippie stuff, or at least where the hippie stuff went.
Well, it was like, the Beats to McCarthy as punks to Reagan. So yeah, makes sense.
It's interesting how punk has these sort of like two dualities running throughout it, where you do have this sort of like highfalutin beatnik Patti Smith thing, but at the same time you have this sort of dictators, dead
Dead
boys.
boys. I was just gonna say Stiv. You got Patty and you got Stiv.
Yeah, like, but there's some in, but it makes sense when you think about Patti Smith and Stiv hanging out together for some reason.
Hanging out with Hilly Crystal, probably, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's certainly like this sort of like dual axis running throughout punk history, and like, and at different times they kind of like fall out of sync with each other a little bit more, and you get something like Oi or Orange County Hardcore, and then other times, you get stuff like Egg Punk happening.
Yeah, Oi and Orange County, are not that far apart, right? It's
No, exactly. That's what I mean. Like that's where I think it loses a little bit of the poetry.
easier to take a left turn than a right turn. Yeah.
Earlier you mentioned being on that 1991 Your Punk Broke kind of, I guess that's what it's called because of the documentary, but that period just before it all explodes. And I know a lot is made about the shift that happens post Nirvana, but I'm wondering, did you feel like it was kind of going that way anyway? Because that's the way it looks to me when I watch that movie and I look at the materials from that time. Like obviously Nirvana was a thing that happened, a huge thing that happened, but it feels like it was going that way regardless of Nirvana or not.
Well, punk got professional, right? I think of somebody like Ray Farrell, who was college radio and then went to SST right around the time Flip Your Wig came out. And Ray knew how to work college radio on songs. And I think, if my history is right, Ray went over to Geffen and was there just as Nirvana was getting ready to take off. So, all the roads were paved already, and all the seeds were in the ground, Pixies and stuff that was happening. So, for Nirvana, it was just a, I mean, right message, right sound, right time. All the stuff was ready for that. Is hair metal was getting a little long in the tooth, and here comes this band where the singers, pro anybody's sexuality is fine. Don't beat on the young women that come to the show. That kind of it was just perfect, right? So, it somebody was going to do it, and it's funny because at the same time was Pearl Jam, which was a distinctly different vibe in my ears. And eyes, I saw them as very different, but then it sort of all sort of amalgamated into grunge, which I don't know.
It's interesting too, because you're right, Pearl Jam to me had such a different vibe from Nirvana feeling, but they're both coming from literally the same scene in some ways.
Yep, and I mean there was so much stuff up there. Hooskers, I mean. Fuck, Soundgarden's second show was opening for Husker Du. So I mean there was always, there was the U-Men, there was stuff up there happening before Seattle blew up. There was always, I mean, I think about the farts at, Gorilla Gardens or
You guys and the Silly Killers.
there you go.
Because
or Melvin's or I mean there was so much stuff going on up there.
you played with Malfunction, and that seems to me like a band that obviously tragedy struck, but they were a band that seems like they would have been destined for much bigger things.
Yeah, well, I think with Nir I think again, I think with Nirvana, it was a good message, a good story, great guys. Time was right, ground was ready, roads are paved. Couldn't. It's yeah, it was just the right. It was the right time for that to happen. And I guess Dave Markey captured a lot of it. But yeah, I was, at a fair amount of those shows in summer of 91, the Europe, festivals, the trashing of dressing rooms, right before Nevermind came out. And then I ended up like, touring in their wake, like October of 91, showing up at a club. And why doesn't the soundboard work? Oh, Nirvana were here last night. Put a guitar through it. And we go again tonight.
Yeah, I don't know any band that's ever been rich enough. Even the Foo Fighters, where they're willing to go out there and smash the gear every single night.
Yeah, I mean, Nirvana were, that was one of a kind, you know. I mean, it was all of the madness of, you know, peak Who, you know, with, you know, with a, you know, sort of power trio with, you know, drummer who ended up singing a bunch as well. I don't know. That seemed novel, I guess. I loved them. I thought, yay, we won. You know, I was very happy. And also, you know, I mean, you know, being, you know, considered earlier, you know, as somebody could possibly work on Nevermind. I mean, I knew them. I knew the songs. I didn't know Teen Spirit. It wasn't on the demos that I got, but I was so happy that Butch Vig, you know, worked his wonders and his magic and all of his skills on that record. It really, you know, everything turned out perfect.
Yeah, and like you said, like what a of anyone to kind of break through and get that kind of platform. Like he had a positive message, pro-gay, anti-fascist, just constantly putting up cool obscure bands, repping cool obscure stuff. Like that's what you'd hope someone would do if they got that opportunity. And that's the person you'd hope would have that opportunity.
Yep, he definitely put, you know, shining a light on other people that they like and challenging the system, you know, while being part of the system. And then that's always the rub, right? You know, when you then when you get you try to change the system and you get in the system and then you become the system, and then the system takes, you know, the system gives and the system takes away. And you know, it's just that's how it sort of feels sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, and like not to get back to tragic stuff, but it's almost like there is like this sort of unbelievable success with that band, but then there's also the ultimate tragedy that undercuts. And I feel like, I don't know, I'm interested to get your take on this actually, because this comes up on the show where I kind of wonder if punk rock guilt, not undercutting obviously the addiction and mental health and physical health issues that Kurt was feeling too, but I feel like punk rock guilt was certainly something that weighed heavy on him, it seems.
Perhaps, yeah, I don't know for sure, but yeah, to you know, to fight and scrape and have a breakthrough and bring your friends along, and then it start, you know, then when you get super big and a lot of people are counting on you, they sort of tighten, you know, the screws get tightened because the boat gets bigger and can't take on water. And yeah, I mean, I you know, I think it must have been really hard. I never had that experience, but I've been around people who have, and it's tough, you know, because you grow up a punk rock kid and then all of a sudden you are on top of the world. And it's not like boy band stuff, but you know, not dissimilar. You know, I guess that kind of world is more like the Disney world where you know, like 4 years old, you sort of learn the system and you're in it for life.
Well,
And until they're done with you, until you're too old, you know, or whatever.
and those boy bands now are your peers. And like it goes from having a bunch of punk bands being the people that you're not competing with, but just existing with, to existing with these pop artists where, like, I granted I don't know what their motivations are, but at least the approach is so different from the world that we come out of.
Yeah, it's very, it's all, I mean, it's a system, you know. It's again, it's like get on the rail, you know, get on the Epcot train, you know. This is how you do it. This is our system, and this is how we do it. Yeah, I don't know that. I mean, I learned on an $80 guitar, and I kept breaking high E strings. You know, that's I didn't have wardrobe, you know, when I was seven. It was.
But then, like, there's also, like you're saying, there's a system, and there starts to be all these people that, not because they're greedy or they're leeches or whatever stereotype the Max rock and roll version of reality painted for me, but they're just people doing their job, but they're all depending on you. So these pressures to keep you doing what you're doing are very real.
Yes, that's the downside, I think, of any business. And I think, rock stars first, athletes next, Wall Street tycoons next, then big tech and big pharma. I mean, it's like there's like new all kinds of new rock stars, right? People like inventive people who come up with these billion-dollar ideas, and everybody invests in it, and then there's the pressure to constantly deliver. It happens in all walks of life, but I, you know, there, you know, sp sp you know, sports heroes didn't make big dollars until what, cable television, maybe?
Yeah, oh, you know better than me. I'm less of a sports fan other than wrestling than you, I think.
But I try to think, even if I think about wrestling, remember they used to like Wahoo McManus, like I was playing, he was a star in the New York Jets, but he made like five, he made five times the money as a pro wrestler in the off season. So, I don't think like, Mantle and Ruth and, Dr. J, all these guys, there was no like $250 million contracts, or not even adjusted for, and, adjusted backwards for inflation kind of thing. There was nothing anywhere near close to that in sports, but in rock and roll, there was always big box office, or Hollywood, there was big box office. So yeah, one person sustaining, hundreds of people's livelihoods, they all look to that person and make sure that they keep producing eggs,
And I know you've talked about this a lot, and you do that. That's obviously a big part of your book too, but there's this moment with Husker Du where you're like, this cannot continue, like this cannot go on. But there, did you feel a pressure like, okay, we can fake this, we can make this go on, like there's, because there is that pressure around you, especially at that point, because you are not going for it, but like you are on that next stage, that next level.
We're in the system. We're on a major label, and there's, release schedules are determined many months in advance, and tour, everything is a machine. And that's all great. As far as Husker Du feeling, I don't think it was anything to do with Warner's. I mean, there was pressure, of course, to clean up the sound or get a name producer or do, that kind of stuff. Get rid of your booking agent, get a professional booking agent. Those things, yeah. And we just say, no, we're not doing that. But I think as far as the disintegration of Husker Du, at 64 years of age, I look back and I see three people who were growing apart for three different reasons. And I don't know if the destinations that we were headed towards were that much better than trying to save the band. But I think that's what happened. I think just everybody went their own way slowly, and by the end, it was sort of broken. And then I think there was a half-hearted, I think earnest, but maybe not ringing attempt to keep it going or put it back together. And then it just got weird, and like, nah, I gotta go.
Which ultimately, you've had an incredible career, and this is just like one chapter in, literally just a few chapters in the book, obviously. But at the same time, like at that stage, you're one of the, at least from the outside, like one of the biggest bands to come out of our world, certainly doing this on this level. There's almost like, oh man, is this my one? Maybe this is just my own insecurities being projected onto you, but there's like, is this my one shot? Like, do we just fuck it? I'm going to keep this together no matter what. Kick out somebody, get someone new in, do this kind of shit, which happens a lot with bands. But there's a part in the book where you talk about it, and you're just, I find the assuredness and the understanding that this cannot go on. Like, there's a maturity that I don't know if I had or have. To kind of be able to walk away from this thing that's a business.
Yeah, I mean, with Hooskers, it was just, I mean, it was all we had when we started. That was all, it was everything went to the band. Every dollar we had, every minute that we had, it all went towards making Husker Du the best band in the world. I mean, we would go, go see U2, on their first tour and just go, this is what people are talking about? No knock on U2, but it's just like, come on. Come on. I'm just like on a bad day. And
They
then
came out
there,
of.
so that's the kind of, I mean, that's how we rolled. I mean, we looked at it like, we're the fuck, we're fucking Husker Du. We're the fucking best band in the world. Fuck you.
We've taken on the hipsters in a death match. Who the fuck are you too?
But we live to tell.
Yes, exactly.
They got color and they did the job. No.
Bob, I could punish you forever, and I have kept you for a very long time. But at some point in the future, would you come back for a part three?
Of course. Of course. This is always a hoot.
Well,
It
anytime you want to come on here and talk about wrestling, or I didn't even ask you about the litters. I wanted to ask you about the litters, but I'll
and
save
talk
that for
about my
later.
fabulous new album.
Oh, that's what I, that's how I, don't worry, I plugged that in the beginning, and they, people will be hearing me sing that praises for a while on that record. Well, actually, your approach to being an artist and having a career that, goes into decades where you can kind of keep approaching records with a new perspective every single time. And I wanted to know, like, when you go into the songwriting process, the record writing process, do you look at it as being, this is the last thing I'm going to do, or do you look at it as being another chapter in an ongoing book?
It's the next thing I'm gonna do. It this one was tough because I Blue Hearts, I wrote that record in a just a hot moment of anger in 2019 because I was pretty upset with the way the world was going. And that I finished recording that prior record in March of 2020, and then I was out of work for 2 years. As most of us were, and it was, this one was slow to come to me. So, I think a lot of it, I mean, you may or may not subscribe to this idea that like for me, my life is defined by the records I make because it's a cycle. It's like I gather up my thoughts and I write, I gather up players and we record. Then there's that awkward in between, and then it comes out, and then you tour. And for me, when I tour, that's when I get the real report card, because I'm out there playing this new stuff that I is near and dear and brand new, and I'm having to put it in with this catalog that everybody is really familiar with, and that's how I see if I'm doing good work, is like, how does this fit with the old work? So to have 2 years where I couldn't tell if I did a good job sort of got in the way of figuring out if I was doing good work in 21 and onward. So, this one for me, it's about the 3 years of solo electric with a handful of new songs and going out to the merch table and listening to other people's stories. And I mean, that's how I got back on track with this one. I didn't see it as my last record, but and I don't ever really want to think about the last record because hopefully I will be expired when that record
I feel like I approach every record like it's my last record. Like I feel like that's why I'm not able to look at it in terms of cycles with it, because I feel like I've got a fatalist approach to music that I think prevents me from ever considering myself a musician.
you are way more prolific than most of us.
Well,
You
you're saying me, but.
have this ambition thing that this thing where you're pushing stuff out all the time. I really admire that. I remember that. As now as I get older, it's like I gotta write. I gotta write. It doesn't fall out. I was like, I gotta go digging.
I know I you give me the credit, and I get no I deserve no credit for that. It's all Mike and Jonah. Like I'm like you. I think it takes me a lot longer to get into a place where I feel like I'm ready to write a song. Like once I start writing the songs normally come pretty quickly, but I have to have like it feels like it's always like pulling something out of me to write a song a little bit, I find.
Yeah, but I mean, look at One Day. I mean, what the hell?
Yeah, we but that's like for that's the thing. I lucked out with One Day because then, well, I didn't luck out, but we had the pandemic. So my One Day wound up being a year and a half
Okay.
because I put away those songs once I realized like, oh, we're not going to be able to finish this record. But I just had the melodies in my head for a year and a half where I'm kind of coming up with lyrics and thinking about stuff. So when I sat down to write, oh my gosh, it came very quick because I'd
Yeah,
been
bottled up. It's nuts.
exactly like that was my, I think that's the thing. It's like you said with Blue Hearts post pandemic or even during the pandemic and lead up to pandemic, there was like an urgency I felt to do stuff that. And then once we had the pandemic stop, I think it changed the way I look at everything. I'm a lot more appreciative, and I think it makes me want to be a little more, I don't know, like cautious with the songs I write. I don't know if that's the right word, but I don't know. It just changed my approach a little bit more.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Just keep writing. Just
Yeah,
keep
just keep
writing.
writing. Yeah,
Just
I
keep
feel.
writing. You can always edit later. Don't edit
Yes.
while you're writing.
Also, I definitely wanted to ask you, what is your take on like looking at the punk scene now? Because you talk about in the book, punk rock back in the 80s and hardcore in particular being don't ask, don't tell when it came to sexuality. And certainly in the last 10 years, it feels like punk has changed a lot. And it's been a consistent evolution, I feel like, looking at it from an outside and as a heterosexual person, I mean, but like it feels like the scene now has kind of caught up with the ideals a lot more. And I was wondering what your take on what you see kind of happening now in punk.
Well, I mean, punk hardcore, those, it's land of misfit toys, and all are welcome as long as you don't wreck the place. So I think that was that sort of don't advertise, don't worry kind of thing, where there was room for everybody as long as you brought something. Well, hopefully time, hopefully, I mean, that was like, and that was 40 plus years ago, and that was, 80s and HIV, and Reagan, and I mean, yeah, we all had to band together and just try to stay alive. I mean, a lot of us didn't have places to live. We're living out of a duffel bag, and shit was real. It's so if there's been progress from that, that's great. I'm in terms of, sexuality, I mean, I think the world is a different place. I fear that the world is becoming yet another different place. So I'm very sad about that. And I don't know. I don't want to be the old, I don't want to be like the old gay guy that just bitches about all my friends are dead. But there's cautionary tales, and in this day and age, get off the screen, get out of the house. Please protest in person, and then you'll end up on social media.
Well, anytime you want to come on here and talk about protests, wrestling, punk, Bob, whatever, you are always welcome.
It's always great to talk with you. I love telling stories with you. It's so much fun. Thank you for having me.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.